Hello and welcome to this episode of Invest Africa Insights. This year, African tech startups raised over $1 billion for the first time, and that milestone was reached in July in the midst of a global pandemic. It's clear that the tech opportunity in Africa is huge, and if anything, this has only been reinforced by the profound disruptions of COVID-19. Today, to talk about the investment opportunity in African tech, I'm delighted to be joined by Fred Steiner, Portfolio Manager at BCCM Advisors, an alternative asset manager focused on investing in businesses that are on the right side of long-term trends. Fred, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here. Appreciate it.
So Fred, you know, after building up for the last couple of decades, really, the tech story in Africa seems to be really taking off now. And in some ways, it's the sort of ultimate long-term business trend of the moment. And we're also still perhaps only at the beginning, really, of what could be a significant growth trajectory. And investing in tech isn't just about sort of startups that tend to grab the headlines. It's also about investing in the tech infrastructure that allows businesses to thrive. So perhaps to kick us off, you could give us just a bit of background to BCCM and what your approach has been to investing in that African tech space.
Sure. Yeah, I guess like would want to step back and start with this idea of like the internet's been around for like 25 years for all intents and purposes. And if you think about like the infrastructure layer kind of the internet, that was really kind of founded with AWS in 2002. And so what this infrastructure layer allows or enables is for pointy businesses, as Alex Danko likes to call them. These pointy businesses can now be built on top of this infrastructure layer. And so what do these pointy businesses do? They provide highly differentiated services to consumers, to B2B customers, and to underserved customers, which we know Africa is plenty of. And then, so this is 2002. And then kind of fast forward to 2007. And like, well, using the iPhone isn't probably the best example of for African adoption of mobile handsets. It's really the first use case of smartphones, right, globally. So that's only like, what, 14 years ago? And so you now have these like pointy businesses that are able to be built on this utilitarian infrastructure, and they can be distributed. Their services can be distributed through mobile handsets. And that begins around 2007. But now if you want to be able to transact with a customer, right, you have to, digital payments are obviously ideal, right? As opposed to using cash. Cash is dirty. It's super expensive to move around cash, especially when you have to move it in bulk. You know, digital payments in Africa didn't really kickstart until kind of the godfather of mobile money, Safaricom, which also started in 2007. And if you think about Safaricom, like what an amazing company and business that they've created around M-Pesa, but the use cases for payments haven't been particularly diverse until recently, and they're really doubling down on use cases. And you're seeing this throughout the continent, right? So now you're able to transact with your customer base. And then if you think about, logistics. First of all, logistics are super hard to begin with, especially so in Africa. And in around, I think it was like 2019, Imperial Logistics, who's based out of South Africa, begins downsizing their business and really focusing on becoming the gateway to Africa. And so Imperial Logistics now has been acquired by DP World, which is a much larger organization, port operator. And then you have simultaneously the likes of like Lorry Systems out of Kenya, Kobo 360 out of Nigeria, Trella being founded in Egypt. And so now you have all these logistics providers being able to tackle and deliver the goods. So kind of recapping, we've got these pointy businesses on top of this infrastructure layer, able to sell and transact with their customers via mobile phones on payment rails, and the goods can be delivered. And so none of this really existed 10 years ago. A lot of it didn't exist 5 years ago. and this ability to do it. And so this is why we're just so excited for the next 10 years, 20 years of this really secular long-term trend of what we think Africa in many respects will grow up on the internet. So the way we invest, given that framework, is we are a consumer and tech enabled fund. We can do private as well as public investments. Today we're primarily public, but that's not to say we don't do privates, and we tend to invest in later stage private businesses. I don't have that dark magic to be able to do founders related stuff. What do we look for? Well, it's consumer and technology businesses that are on the right side of long-term trends, that offer products or services that either directly or indirectly exponentially enrich the lives of Africans. We love founder-led businesses where employees have skin in the game too. Some of the businesses will be copycat business models from elsewhere in the world, whether that's developed markets or other emerging markets. And that's just because at the end of the day, we're all human beings and generally have similar interests. And you know, we just want to make our lives easier and reduce friction at the end of the day. Similarly, many of the businesses are going to be built to solve problems that are unique to Africa. Either way, there needs to be product traction. And that's why we stay within our lane of investing in later stage privates and in public markets.
And you mentioned there really sort of how endless the possibilities are, which is sort of almost a double-edged sword, because there's a lot of opportunity, but then also you've got to try find a way to navigate and to identify the most successful opportunities. And you're really talking cross-sector and cross-market. So how do you manage that within your own investments? Are there any sectors that you prioritize, any sectors you prefer not to look at? How do you prioritize the way you're looking at these?
So first of all, it's turning over a lot of stones. Zoom, in a way, has made this a lot easier. On the other hand, we just did our first trip since the onset of the pandemic to Egypt, and we were able to meet with a number of tech companies in Cairo, as well as publicly listed companies that we've invested in or have been looking at. And ideally, we want to spend half a day with the company and built around this. We'll have spoken with customers or suppliers and studied the industry and competitors to the extent they exist, go through the financials. Perhaps we've put out a survey for consumers to better understand adoption and preferences, purchasing behaviors. Where possible, we'd love to consume the product or service ourselves so that we can get a tangible feel for it. So at the end of the day, we're looking for businesses that are really making people's lives better and easier, whether that's as a consumer or for employees within a business, because at the end of the day, we're all humans and we want to make our lives easier. So we're really looking for these pointy businesses I spoke of that provide highly differentiated services that people and businesses really value. And these companies do so by sharing some of the economic value to not only drive adoption, but maintain very high retention rates. And this gets the flywheel going. And then once you have the flywheel going, you're able to layer on more products and services. So obviously with travel shut down, the personal interactions have not been as easy to do without travel. On the other hand, Zoom has enabled us to be able to turn over, Zoom and Teams have enabled us to be able to turn over a lot more stone.
And so you're really looking in that sweet spot then, I suppose, of businesses that have established themselves and could be on the verge of sort of a major expansion phase.
Yep, that's correct. And I'd say we typically spend anywhere from 3 to 6 months trying to really get to know a space before we'll pull the trigger. And then once we're comfortable with the space, so we'd spent a lot of time on payments naturally. And so the portfolio right now is a reflection of a number of fintech companies. It has solid representation within the portfolio, but that was also due to several years of investment or of research. And then, as you find more companies that you like, you're able to pull the trigger. So.
And you're based in the US, and we've spoken a fair bit on this podcast about the US tech scene and tech investment scene and how to bring it into Africa, or how to garner more interest in African markets there. I'm just curious, really, from your perspective, what kind of reaction do you get if you're speaking to US investors, and how do you, what's your sort of pitch, really, for why Africa is a good place to look at?
Yeah, so I think it's certainly gotten easier. We launched a couple of years ago. The story has gotten easier. I think in ways, performance has certainly helped. And just getting out there and telling the story and getting people more familiar with Africa, certainly at the beginning, the biggest hurdle was corruption. And so you kind of had to convince people, well, there is corruption everywhere. But that's no longer probably the biggest resistance to our story. I think this idea and the fact that the internet breaks down geographic barriers, and the fact that we focus on technology where distribution is kind of effectively infinite, has really resonated with investors here in the United States. And one thing I would add is, like, as you're seeing more and more VC money flow into Africa, like with the likes of Avenir, like YC, and the number of startups they're backing and supporting, Ribbit Capital, Stripes getting involved, of course. And then anecdotally, I believe Tiger Global made one investment in all of Africa historically, and this year they've made three. And so I think seeing some of these almost household names within the investment community pulling the trigger on companies in Africa really has supported this idea that, you know, has really de-risked the idea of investing in Africa.
And now, one of the sort of challenges that African tech businesses have sometimes faced is this idea that there are lots and lots of smaller or medium-sized businesses that are tech-driven, but it's hard, or it has been hard, for many to sort of go to the next level, you know, like the so-called unicorns. And there's a handful up there at that level, your sort of Jumia's, but then, you know, that their listing on the stock exchange was a bit of a disappointment, and it seems to be slightly difficult to move into that next layer. Are you seeing that change, or what do you think needs to change to allow more African sort of medium-sized tech companies to really grow into those kind of global players?
Yeah, I think in some cases the biggest challenge is that these companies need to go out and build some of their own infrastructure. So you've heard, like, Jumia is a good example because they've, you know, a much larger company now. But when they started doing, when they started the business, and even like 5 years ago, you recently heard Sasha say on an earnings call, like, we had to go out and build our logistics infrastructure. And that's why we're doing logistics as a service, is because it just didn't exist. It was too difficult to do e-commerce without owning some level, some form of logistics infrastructure. And so I think some of the times, you know, that can be the biggest hurdle. I'd say one of the things that we're quite optimistic about going forward is just the level and optimism that governments have expressed. You know, if you think about how large the informal economies are in many of these countries, it just means that the government isn't able to tax. And so if you're able to get everyone to shift to digital payments, then you're leaving a paper trail. And so, like, governments want to increase that, you know, broaden the tax net. And in that process, they're supporting and supportive of digitization.
So if we turn then now, maybe, Fred, to look at some markets in a bit more detail, add a bit of color perhaps to this picture. Obviously, there are certain markets you hear a lot about, especially in the tech space, you know, sort of your Egypts, your Nigerias. Is that where you're focused in on? What are the pockets of activity that you're really looking at closely at the moment?
Yeah, sure. Why don't we talk about Egypt, just given that we just got back from Cairo, as I mentioned earlier. And frankly, it's a large portion of the portfolio at the moment. And so I guess, like, the bear case on Egypt over the past several years has been this weak balance of payments. And then this was, you know, they've had a just tumultuous 10-year period between revolution, devaluation, and then, yes, again, COVID, right as the economy seems to be stabilizing. And again, this weak balance of payment exacerbated by COVID because the kind of an oil veiled play on oil, given the relationship with the GCC, and lots of Egyptians go work in the GC and then send money, remit money back home. And then tourism, tourism goes basically to zero. And so this really exacerbates the current account deficit and requires the central bank to keep interest rates or real rates elevated to attract foreign debt investors who invest in local debt and exchange their dollars for Egyptian pounds. And this is able to prop up the currency. But with oil having recovered and then now tourism returning, interest rates, we believe, can come down. Now, I'll stress that while we are bottom-up focused, we have to keep some level of eye on the macro policy front. But we're not trying to forecast anything here. But if interest rates do come down, this will support this. There's been this long narrative that there would be this private CapEx boom in Egypt. And just each year, it just never comes to fruition. But this is, we believe, in large part due to the elevated real interest rates. Over the medium term, we met with a number of this tech community startup, and it's burgeoning. It's just like you walk through these offices and people are hustling and bustling and grinding. And one of my favorite scenes from the entire trip was walking out at 7:30 p.m. after having met with a team, and we look next door, and the company they're basically trying to displace, lights off, cars, the parking lot's empty. And you look back at this tech company, and lights are on. You can see people running around through the windows. People are outside talking. It's just a terrific vibe to see. And then back on the government support, Egypt is one of at the forefront of supporting digital payments.
No, and you mentioned that's something that's really hard to, I suppose really hard to measure or really hard to capture, which is some of that sort of energy factor. And I'm just curious, because obviously it's been a very difficult couple of years. And even though perhaps tech isn't so impacted as a sector, by some of the disruption that we've seen from COVID, I'm just curious, how have you sort of experienced that? How in the companies that you've been working with, companies in your portfolio, how have they managed? And you know, has it changed your thinking at all, or has it sort of more reinforced your approach?
No, I think it's reinforced our approach, and we've candidly become more and more bullish on this flywheel gaining traction. This digitization flywheel gaining traction. You know, one thing on the payment side is our research suggests that when nations reach a transaction value as a percentage of GDP, when it reaches 20%, that there starts to be this tipping point towards everyone kind of adopting digital transactions. And you know, just a few years ago, there was very few countries on this list, and now it's closer to about a dozen last I counted. And so to the extent you get more and more digital payments going on, that's just like one of the, as we spoke earlier, it's just one of the base layers or foundation layers of commerce. And so no, I would say our approach hasn't really changed, or our viewpoints haven't really changed, except that perhaps digitization is happening more quickly than we had anticipated when we first set about to launch this fund. And maybe COVID, you know, kind of drove that.
I mean, you sound like you're pretty bullish and pretty optimistic about Africa as an investment destination. But I always like to ask guests if they sort of project forwards into the future, maybe 5-10 years in the future, what's the trend, the market, the sector in Africa that makes you particularly excited? What is it that gets you up in the morning and sort of keeps you going?
Honestly, it's just that technology can be used to tackle some of the world's most challenging and pressing problems. We've spoken about Egypt. So Egypt consumes roughly 60 to 65% of their wheat and corn or maize imports. And so they're highly dependent on importing food, basic food staples, right? And then they've got this kind of issue going on with the Ethiopia and the dam. But like we could certainly see a world where, and they're extremely dependent on the Nile. But even just like simple things like drip irrigation systems can make remarkable gains in productivity. And so I think it's just, at the end of the day, it's really technology being used for a force of good to tackle some of these challenges. And so you could see a world where Egypt isn't nearly as dependent on imports of wheat and corn. And that's just, I don't know. It makes me extremely excited.
Great. Fred, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on to speak to me today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And if people want some more information about BCCM, do check out the description. There'll be a little bit more information there and some information about how to get in touch as well, if you want to reach out to Fred and his team.